Welcome to the Food for Your Soul podcast, where we apply the Word of God to the hearts of men and women to stoke the fires of your delight in Christ.
Romans 8:20, for the creation was subject to futility, not by its own choice, but by the will of him who subjected it, in hope that the creation itself would be liberated from its bondage to decay. That's a reference to the curse. Someday, Jesus is going to come and reverse that. He's going to come and he's going to do a complete remodel on this whole place. We'll have a brand new sky, brand new earth, and all problems will be eliminated. All of them eliminated. But until that time, we're living in a fallen, cursed, messed up world. And the book of Ecclesiastes is written to teach us how to live in a world like that, how to deal with the problems that come from the curse. So last week, we began our study in the book of Ecclesiastes, and we saw that the author, who is referred to in this book as the preacher, is on a quest to try to get a step ahead of the curse. Just try to get a grip on it. He wanted to control wild card unpredictable providence, and he wanted to know more than what God had revealed. He wanted to get enough knowledge to be able to gain control so that he could have predictable, controllable happiness. He makes this massive effort to gain control over his own happiness, and here's where he ends up. Chapter 2, verse 17, take a look. He says, therefore, I hated life. I hated life because the work that was done under the sun is so distressing to me. Verse 18, I hated all my work that I labored at under the sun. That's his big conclusion. Why did you hate life, Solomon? Well, he's going to tell us. Chapters 1 and 2 are the reason why he hated life. He tells us what's so horrible about life. And the first thing about life that bothered him so much was the fact that it's so short. It's impossible for him to get enough knowledge. It's impossible for humanity to gain control and make any progress because of the tiny little lifespan we have. Verse 4, a generation goes and a generation comes, but the earth remains forever. Verse 5, the sun rises and the sun sets, panting. It returns to the place where it rises, gusting to the south, turning to the north, turning, goes the wind, and the wind returns to its cycles. All streams flow into the sea, and yet the sea's never full. The streams are flowing to the place, and then they flow again. I mean, they just keep getting replenished. The whole earth keeps replenishing itself. Rivers run and run, and they never run out of water. Wind blows away, it comes back. You know, everything around us is spent and renewed. And it disappears and it reappears. Everything in the world is like that except us. We just go away. Short little lifespan. This piece of wood is going to outlive me. And potentially my children and grandchildren. Generations come, generations go. He says it's like each generation just like marches off the cliff, and the next one comes and marches off the cliff, and they just that fast be gone, and we won't be remembered. And what am I in this generation? I mean, of all the billions of people on the planet, I'm just one little speck. I'm one person. I'm one drop of water in this whole river. And the river is nothing. I'm just a speck. I'm nothing. And I think I'm going to get a handle on the universe and gain understanding of everything God's doing and control providence. I can't even keep peas on my fork. You know, I'm going to figure out the mysteries of the universe. I can't even figure out where I left my glasses half the time. The point here is that we're so tiny and so temporary, and we have so much human limitation that we can never back up far enough to get the big picture. We can't see it all. We're just right up next to the wall. All you can see is one little piece. And so verse 8, all things are wearisome. Man is unable to speak. The eye's not satisfied by hearing. The ear's not filled with hearing. No matter how much you study, no matter how much you learn, there's an infinite amount left to see and hear. You can't take it all in. And for that reason, we can't make any progress. Any real progress. Verse 9, what has been is what will be. And what has been done is what will be done. There's nothing new under the sun. Nothing new. Why? Because, verse 11, there's no remembrance of those who came before. See, we can't. One generation dies, the next generation replaces it, and some knowledge is passed along to the new generation, but not much. Most of it isn't. I mean, it's not like I pick up where my dad left off as soon as I'm born and I start progressing beyond him. If I can make it by age 50 to where my dad was when he was 50, I'm doing pretty good. And it's the same with generations. There's only a tiny fraction of things that ever get recorded in history. And even the stuff that does get recorded, nobody can take it all in. Nobody can read it all and learn it all. People say those who don't learn history are bound to repeat it. You know that saying? People that say that are typically people who imagine that they have learned enough history, they're not bound to repeat it. That's a fantasy. Nobody knows that much history. Everybody's going to repeat it. That's what he's saying here. Human history is just one long, giant story of the same things happening over and over and over. Nothing of significance ever really changes. Just as the rivers and the wind and the sun are in constant motion and continual change, resulting in perpetual sameness, so it is with humanity. Nothing is new. There's nothing new under the sun. Nothing. You say, what about the electric toothbrush? I mean, that's new, right? I mean, what about cars and computers and cell phones and space travel and, you know, well, those things are impressive, but what have they really changed? I mean, is the human race fundamentally different now because of those things? Do we have fewer problems because we have computers? Ha! Because of the incredible processor speed of my computer at home is capable of generating tens of thousands of new problems per second. Just think of how many of your problems are related to your computer and your car and your house and your cell phone and all these wonderful, marvelous, life-changing things of modern invention that are the source of most of our problems. Why is that? Because just like the river's flowing, the wind blowing, there's an appearance of a lot of change, but in the big picture, everything's just staying the same. Just staying the same. I open my Bible, I read about people that lived 3,000 years ago, and guess what? All the problems they have, I still got those same problems. The big problems. You know, when you read the Psalms, you don't hear them crying out and lament, oh God, I can't travel at 75 miles an hour on the freeway. I can't talk across distances. I have to go over on foot. I can't fly overseas. I have no GPS. God save me from this. You don't hear that. That's not their problem. What are their big problems? Injustice, sickness, disease, death, sin, all that kind of stuff. That's all still here, just as much as it was then. We've gotten nowhere. There's nothing out there so different from what you already have that it would give you control of life. Nobody's got a new angle. Nobody's got anything new. If they think it's new, it's just because they don't know enough history. And so Solomon says, look, everyone's scrambling around. Listen, life is it's an exercise bike. You get on one generation, jumps on, pedals like mad until finally they die and fall off. Another generation gets on and it starts pedaling. And they say, well, you didn't pedal hard enough. We'll pedal harder because you didn't get anywhere. And he says, it's never going to go anywhere. The preacher thought that if he could just gain enough knowledge, he'd be there. He'd be in Fat City. He could gain control. He could get on top of the rat race. Chapter 1, verse 12. I, the preacher, have been king over Israel in Jerusalem. I applied my mind to seek and explore through wisdom all that is done under heaven. I want to get a handle on all of it. And he tried to do that through science. You know, he observed how things go, applied sound reasoning to those observations, and attempted to develop theories to explain it all. Now, does that sound familiar? That's the culture we live in for sure, right? That's us. I mean, science education is the solution to everything, right? Solution to everything. You got teen pregnancy, how do you deal with that? Education. More education. What are these sex education schools? Where did that get us? They just understand exactly what they're doing while they're getting pregnant. They're still getting pregnant. We have education coming out of our ears and our problems aren't going away. But the culture doesn't learn. They say, no, more education, just more awareness. That's all we need, just more awareness, right? Awareness, awareness. You hear that all the time. Breast cancer? No problem. Awareness. We'll just have the football players wear pink shoes and the games and everybody will become aware, you know, that breast cancer is a problem. And we have ribbons and campaigns and billboards and public service announcements and awareness is at an all-time high. And yet, amazingly, women are still getting cancer. Now, is there any value in science? Absolutely. Tremendous value. I love science. I'm riveted by it. I'm so fascinated by science. I can't get enough of it. It fascinates me because it shows me the glory of God. So I love science, but does it give me control over the big issues in life? No. No. Will it exempt me from wildcard providence? No. Most brilliant scientists in the world still get flat tires in the rain. Their kids will still leave stuff out in the yard and it gets ruined. They still get the flu. They lose their car keys. They're not exempt. The preacher tried to get above all that through science and education. In verse 14, he says, I found everything to be futile, a pursuit of the wind. It didn't work. Why didn't it work? Verse 15, what is crooked cannot be straightened. And what is lacking can't even be counted. You know, so many things are lacking in our ability to understand it all. You can't even count how much stuff that's unknowable. I mean, you can't, and what's crooked can't be straightened out. There's things in life that are just bent, and you can't straighten them out. Science can observe and measure how bent they really are, but it can't straighten them out. Why? Because, get this, God is the one who bent it. It's the curse, verse 13. God, now this is the first mention of God in the book. God has given people this miserable task to keep them occupied, or better translation, by which they are occupied. Point is, God made it this way. It's the curse. It was God who subjected the world to frustration, and all my plans to be the captain of my own destiny run aground on the eternal sovereign decree of God in Genesis 3. The only way I could ever gain control of life is if I stormed the gates of heaven and took charge. And that's not going to happen. And not only did God cause all the futility, but God is also the one that prompts the heart of man to seek so much meaning and understanding all the time. See, that we have that appetite. That's God's doing. That's because we're in the image of God. You understand that? We have this divinely implanted desire to have meaning in our lives and significance. We have to get it. You notice animals aren't like that? I mean, you ever notice how different we are from all the animals? No cow is out there in the pasture filled with anxiety, looking down at the grass and just saying, what does it all mean? You know, they don't care. They can stand there all day, every day, just staring at the grass, and they never get bored. How can they do that? How do they do that? I look at my dog at home and say, how does that thing not get bored? Well, dogs, animals, are perfectly content to have no meaning in life because God didn't plant in them the craving for meaning. He hasn't put eternity in their hearts like He has for us. He made us in His image, and as a result, we can never be satisfied with lives that are filled with nothing but momentary sensations. We can't stand emptiness and meaninglessness in our work. We just can't deal with it. We have this voracious appetite for meaning. But then when we try to find that meaning by figuring everything out, the education, just does nothing but increase our questions and our problems. That's verse 17. I applied my mind to know wisdom and knowledge, madness and folly. I learned that this too is a pursuit of the wind. For with much wisdom is much sorrow. And as knowledge increases, grief increases. The more you know, the more problems you realize are out there. I mean, you gain wisdom, you see how things are supposed to go. You get an education, you see how things should be, and then you see them not being that way, and it's maddening. You study history, what do you learn? You learn about Hitler, you learn about Stalin, you study science, what do you learn? You learn about entropy, everything's moving towards disorder. You study physiology, you learn about viruses and incurable diseases, and you learn about all these terrible things, and the more you study, the more you realize, these things are bent and we can't straighten them out. With all our advancements, there's still maniacal murderers running countries, the viruses are only getting worse, and the second law of thermodynamics hasn't been repealed. The more knowledge you gain, the more trouble you have, in every area of life, it increases your trouble, doesn't it? I mean, the more skillful you get in your work, the more money you make, the more often you find yourself awake at night with anxiety. Isn't that true? I mean, some guy's flipping burgers at McDonald's, and he can clock out, go home, forget about his job altogether, have a nice evening, go to bed, and sleep like a baby. But then the more you get your job, you work your way up, you get this prestigious, important job, you're making six figures, whatever, and inevitably you're going to be laying in bed awake at night half the time worrying about all the problems that you now know about. Are you really that much better off than the guy flipping the burgers? So the preacher, he went down that road of science and education, didn't get him happiness and meaning, didn't work, his futility. So now in chapter 2, verse 1, he's going to try another approach. He's going to try something else. If not education, how about fun? It's fun, you know? Chapter 2, verse 1. I said to myself, go ahead, I'll test you with pleasure. Enjoy what is good. That word translated pleasure most often refers to celebration, singing, dancing, eating, drinking, all the elements of a party. Basically, partying is what this word means. Or fun. In the second half of verse 1 can be taken a couple of different ways. I think the NIV probably gets it best. It says, I will test you with pleasure to find out what is good. Remember, that's what he's going after. I want to find out what's good to do, how to live, how to control outcomes. I want to get controllable happiness here. It's all part of the scientific research. He's going to use partying and celebration and laughter and fun to see if through those things he can discover what's the best way to live so I can control outcomes and get ahead of the curse. And maybe it's not education. Maybe that's too serious. Maybe I just need to lighten up and just enjoy. You know, you only go around once. Just enjoy stuff. You heard the saying, if life gives you lemons, make lemonade. What does that mean? What is that statement? What are they saying? Just add sugar, basically. That's what you do, right? You get something, you start out with something unbearably sour, lemon juice, and you just add enough sugar, and you can get a decent drink. I mean, it's never going to be as good as Kool-Aid, but you know, it's drinkable. It's in a pinch. So, that's basically what Solomon's trying to do with life. Life's sour. Just add enough sugar, the sugar of fun, pleasure. You know, life is like this. Life in this cursed, futile world is like a sour grapefruit. And if you sprinkle enough sugar on that thing, you can salvage it. And that's his theory here. Maybe life can become worth living if I just sprinkle some happiness on there. And so maybe this is the key to meaning in life. But verse 1, end of the verse, turned out to be futile. I said about laughter, it's madness. And about pleasure, what does it accomplish? See, the problem with that approach is this built-in craving for meaning. You can't just go the route of comedy, because you'll be devoid of meaning in your life. Laughter feels great while you're doing it, but you can surround yourself with comedians and fun and games and parties and recreation and everything else that makes you laugh, and your life can still go right in the tank, can't it? And that's not the answer. And so he says, it's madness. It's basically temporary insanity. Whenever you laugh, basically it's temporary insanity. You're just blocking out all the reality of life, focusing on one funny thing, and after a few moments, reality returns and sorrow returns and you stop laughing. Now, he is going to tell us in chapter 3, there is a place for laughter. There's a place for that. It's not a bad thing. But it's not going to solve your biggest problems. Well then, how about alcohol? He said, I explored with my mind how to let my body enjoy life with wine and how to grasp folly. My mind still guiding me with wisdom until I could see what is good for people to do under heaven during the few days of their lives. That's another technique people use for getting a handle on life. If you can't control problems, let's at least escape from them, right? Just get some marijuana or some Prozac or have a few beers and just make it so the pain of life just doesn't hurt quite as much. The preacher, he makes a very intentional scientific study in this approach. He says, wisdom was still guiding me. And he says, no, it didn't get me anywhere. I ended up hating life. So then he tries another approach. He turns to work and achievement. If that's just all a bunch of emptiness and folly and there's not enough meaning to it, maybe meaning can come with accomplishing something, getting something done. And so he goes to work. Verse 4, I increased my achievements. I built houses and planted vineyards for myself. I made gardens and parks for myself and planted every kind of fruit tree in them. I constructed reservoirs of water for myself with which to irrigate a grove of flourishing trees. I mean, you read that, you think, man, I was thinking more like just like get my garage cleaned up or something. I mean, he's going all out here. And he ends up, says, I hated life. I ended up hating life. See, all these things, these are the things that we usually fill in the blank in the statement, I will be happy when. You fill in the blank. Don't we all fall into that? I'll just be happy as soon as I can get, right now, my life is a mess. Once I get organized, get focused, I accomplish my dreams, then I'll be happy. Or once I get this, once I get that. And the psalmist says, I've been there, done that, I've tried it all. Dead end. Dead end. Doesn't work at all. Well, something else he tried was money, wealth. I'll get rich. That'll make me happy. I'll be happy when I can get on top of my bills, right? I would be happy when I can get this job, I can get this income, Psalm says, I tried it. I ended up hating life. And he got rich, like rich, rich. Verse 7, I acquired male and female servants. I had slaves who were born in my house. I mean, imagine, you have so much money, you could just hire people to do all the stuff you don't want to do. right? And I also owned many herds and cattle and flocks, and for more than all who were before me in Jerusalem. I also amassed silver and gold for myself and treasures of kings and provinces. He had other kings bringing him money. He had so much money. I mean, he was the richest man on the planet. He was number one on Forbes' richest people list. We daydream about winning the lottery. Lottery. I burned through that in a weekend. You know, he had so much money beyond imagination. It didn't make him happy. He hated life at the end. Well, next, he went after music. Verse 8, I gathered male and female singers for myself. A lot of people do that. They run after music or the arts to get some meaning, to fill up their life, to fill up the empty. They get depressed, they run, they turn on their music. Didn't satisfy. Another angle he went after was sex. He says in the rest of verse 8, and many concubines, the delights of men. Many is right, 300. It's 700 wives, 300 concubines. There was a Playboy mansion way before Hugh Hefner ever came along. And there are men who think, man, if I had my pick of 1,000 playmates, you know, most beautiful women in the country, all living in my mansion, I would be happy. Solomon says, no, I end up hating life. Verse 9, so I became great and surpassed all who were before me in Jerusalem. My wisdom also remained with me. All that my eyes desired, I did not deny them. He said, I got anything I wanted. I didn't have to ever say no. He never drove past a house that he couldn't have. Right? That he couldn't afford. He tried living a life of hedonism. Just say yes to every impulse. You just have an impulse to say yes to it. He tried that. Now, most people who go this route never learn the lesson that Solomon learned because they can never take it to the extremes. They don't have the resources to take it to the extremes that he took it to. Right? They run after wealth and it doesn't satisfy and they think, well, this is because I don't have enough wealth. I just need a little more and a little more. And they can never get to where he just has it all and he realizes, okay, it's not working. And the same thing with all those other pursuits. You name it, whichever one. We don't have the resources to pursue it all the way to the extreme, and so we never learn this lesson. But Solomon did. I mean, he took everything to the extreme. In verse 10, I did not refuse myself any pleasure. This is interesting. For I took pleasure in all my struggles. This was my reward for my struggles. Literally, this was my portion for my struggles. So he admits, I did get some pleasure out of it. I did. It wasn't like it was all misery. I mean, I had some enjoyment along the way. But that ended up being my portion. Your portion, that refers to your lot in life, what you end up with in life, the whole of it. His lot, his reward for all of his struggle was whatever enjoyment he got, whatever pleasure he got along the way, and it was nothing else. You could pencil in your Bible when he says, this was my reward, you could say, in full. This is my reward in full. It didn't lead to meaning. It didn't show him the best way to live. It didn't give him control. It didn't answer the big questions. It didn't exempt him from the futility of the curse. It just gave him some fleeting sensations of pleasure. So there's some benefit to that, but it's a very limited benefit. Verse 11, when I consider all that I had accomplished and what I had labored to achieve, I found everything to be futile in a pursuit of the wind. There was nothing to be gained under the sun. So it's just all futility. Well, what's the solution to all this futility? The solution is this refrain that appears 7 times in the book. The first time is right here in chapter 2, verse 24. Verse 24, there's nothing better for a man than to eat, drink, and enjoy his work. I have seen that even this is from God's hand, because who can eat and who can enjoy life apart from him? The gifts that God has given us in this world, food and drink and all the rest, work, all the gifts in this life, they don't make you, they're supposed to make you happy. They don't. They don't work unless God adds the catalyst of this gift called the ability to enjoy. You see that? And so the question becomes, how do I get that gift? How do I get that catalyst where God gives me the ability to enjoy the stuff that comes my way in life? Verse 26. For to the man who is pleasing in his sight, God gives wisdom and knowledge and joy. But to the sinner, he gives the futile task. I'm so glad you took the time to tune in today. What you just heard was the introduction to the message. Tomorrow's podcast will have the rest of the sermon where we'll find out how you can become more of a God pleaser than you already are and therefore receive more of the gift of the ability to enjoy life.
But for today, let me just give you a couple things to think hard about. And you may want to jot these down, these questions, to use them for family devotions or a small group discussion or conversation starter or just to, in your own time alone with God. Number one, how are you most prone to fill in the blank, I will be happy when? What is it that you think at this point in your career? Suppose it's children or you get married or it's this point in your career, whatever. Imagine yourself getting that thing, but not getting the gift of enjoyment, the ability to enjoy life, so that you end up, like Solomon, hating life. Even though you got the thing that you thought would make you happy, you end up hating life. Imagine, take some time to just picture your life like that. Imagine it. Imagine yourself living it so that you can train your soul to remember that, no, those things, that is not what will make me happy. I will be happy when God gives me the gift of enjoyability, the ability to enjoy life. That's when I'll be happy no matter what the circumstances are. And that's the only time I'll be happy. And number two, what are the last five gifts? Maybe 5 to 10. You got 10 fingers, so maybe go with 10. Count them out. What are the last 5 or 10 things God not only gave you, but also enabled you to enjoy them? Spend some time in communion with God, just thanking Him, just taking delight in the fact that He not only gave you those things, but He gave you a special ability to really enjoy. He gave those same gifts to some other people and didn't give the ability to enjoy. And so those other people didn't enjoy Him. You did. Thank Him for that. And enjoy His love and His favor on your life.
Thank you for listening. If you would like to hear the full-length version of today's message, you can find that on treasuringgod.com or just get our free Food for Your Soul sermon app. And if you find this podcast helpful, you can help other people find it by sharing a link on social media, giving us a rating or review on iTunes, or, best of all, tell a friend about us. Until next time, rejoice in the Lord always and set your mind on things above, for Christ is seated at the right hand of God.